Now, I don't know about you, but I think being a Christian in the UK today is sometimes a bit depressing. It certainly can be just very discouraging and disappointing. And I wonder sometimes if we feel like just kind of doing the routine thing, because it's great in church on a Sunday, isn't it, when we're with our brothers and sisters and doing church things, that's great. But when we're out in the world, as it were, when we're at work, maybe with our family and friends, being a Christian just seems a bit tougher. Maybe then it's just easier not to bother overtly being a Christian. I mean, imagine someone at work in the office, and they're in the office and they try to witness to their friends. And they do that by obviously trying to be honest in work and working hard with integrity. And then at coffee break, lunch times, they try to witness to their friends. And some of their friends, they're okay with that. They say, well, I admire your faith. It's okay for you to be a Christian. It's not my thing, but that's fine. But then aren't there others in the office who they just castigate the very idea that there might be a God? How ridiculous to believe in God. And certainly the Bible's just a pack of lies and nonsense. And as for Christianity, well, it's just rubbish, isn't it? And such a person, of course, then is just thinks, what's the point? People are just so hard. Why do I bother? Or Christian parents, you bring up your children to Sunday school and you teach them the Bible at home and you teach them to believe in Jesus Christ. And then they leave home. And many of us will know they sometimes reject God. And then we just look out in the world, don't we? And we see the decline in moral standards all around us, evidenced by just advertising. It's just, ridiculous. I mean, advertising, how immoral it is. Television on prime time. Declining church attendance. Anti-God legislation in Parliament. And it seems today that any opinion can be aired and honoured and tolerated. This is what we call multiculturalism. And anything goes in morality and spirituality unless you try and say that actually you know what the truth is, because God has shown us in the Bible. Now, well, how does that lead us to respond? I mean, we may not ourselves doubt our faith. We may not ourselves go and say, well, I'm not sure I can believe the Bible anymore. But we may start thinking it's just not worth sharing it because no one's interested. But maybe one or two of us may start to question our faith. If all these people, all these intelligent people, are telling us the Bible's rubbish, tell us that God can't possibly exist, is God real? Did Jesus really die on the cross for my sins? And today, and increasingly, when faithfulness to God and standing for and living by and proclaiming the truth of the Bible, the truth of the gospel, it brings opposition and sometimes painful trials. How should we as Christians live? And why should we bother? If you're feeling marginalized and under pressure and attack from society because you're a Christian, well, be encouraged, first of all, that Daniel knew exactly the same thing. And this book of Daniel has so much to tell us about how we are to live in our kind of society and why we are to do so. Because Daniel was living in a multicultural society where God was not honoured. And he learnt to live a faithful life to God and learnt why he should do that. And we have to remember as we look at these Old Testament accounts, they are true accounts. They aren't fables. They're not myths. They're not children's stories. They're not Aesop's fables. Actually, this is hard history that we're reading. And this book of Daniel shows us what it means to be faithful, living in a multicultural, anything-goes, anti-God society. And tonight in particular, if we look at this very familiar story of Daniel in the lion's den, we'll see how Daniel is faithful. But why? And why should we be faithful? Well, first of all, in verses 1 to 5, we see God's righteous servant. God's righteous servant. Daniel has been living in exile for most of his life. If you flick back to chapter 1, if you know the story, you'll know that he was taken from his land, and he was at that point probably 14 years old, a teenager, a young man, ripped from his home, taken 500 miles away on a long journey with other young men by the mighty King Nebuchadnezzar, taken to a strange and pagan land. And he must have been really amazed as he saw Babylon and the wonders of that city. And there was this young man, faced by all the opportunities and wonders and attractions of the royal court, as he was inducted into the University of Babylon, slated for high office. And there he made a stand that could have cost him his life. And ever since then, Daniel, once he graduated from the University of Babylon, has been in a place of power and influence in a foreign land, in a foreign and pagan government. And he's seen how he's been an influence for good. We've seen in the first four chapters how King Nebuchadnezzar initially was very opposed to God and rejected God and was very proud of his own position, but how God humbled him. And he was brought to know the Lord. And he humbled himself, Nebuchadnezzar, and he said to God, I recognize that you are the God who has put me here. And I think he became a believer. Sometimes Daniel's influence had seemingly no effect. In chapter 5, we read of King Belshazzar, who also rejected God. But he did not respond to the word that Daniel brought him. And he paid the price. And we read in the very preceding verses, in the very end of chapter 5, in verse 30, when Daniel had said what the writing on the wall meant. Remember the story, the writing on the wall. And Daniel said, your life will be taken from you. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Babylon has fallen. That mighty empire has come down. And a new king comes to power. The king of the Medes and the Persians, to establish a new empire. And this new conquering king, he needs some good administrators. He needs some good government. Because it's a very large area he has to rule over. And his empire is expanding. And this guy's 62 years old. He's wise. He's learnt, actually, you can't trust people in government. You put people in government, they'll embezzle, feather their own nest, and all that kind of thing. He knows that happens. So he needs people of honesty and integrity to kind of keep an eye on all the governors. And so he appoints three administrators, vice presidents, if you like. And as one of these vice presidents, he turns to Daniel. Maybe he's heard of Daniel. If Daniel was a senior official, he might have heard of him. Certainly, perhaps he's been told of him by people he's met as he's come into power, having conquered Babylon. As we read at the very beginning of chapter 6, that it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom. These are the regional governors. And there'll be three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. You can see they're there to keep an eye on the satraps. The year is 539 BC, the year that Babylon fell. And we're now 66 years after the events of chapter 1, which occurred around 605 BC. How's your arithmetic? How many years is that? Anyone? 539, 605. 66 years. So if Daniel was 14... Maybe you can answer this one, it's a bit easier. If Daniel was 14 in chapter 1, how old is he now? 80. Excellent. We have one person who knows a bit of arithmetic. Daniel is 80 years old. And Daniel comes, the king comes to him. And here's Daniel in his home. And the king comes or sends somebody over probably and says, I want you to be a vice president. Wonder what Daniel might have said. He could have said this, and he said, I've retired, actually. I've done my bit for government and society. Let the youngsters have a go. It's their turn. It's their responsibility now. I've done my bit. I've earned a good rest, and I deserve a peaceful retirement, and I want to go and put my feet up, play a bit of golf, and go on holidays in Spain. Daniel could have said that, couldn't he? But he doesn't. He takes up this role because Daniel is faithful to God, you see. And he's lived a life of consistent service and obedience to God. And now at the age of 80, the age of David Margetts, he's about to become a vice president of the Persian Empire. What an encouragement that should be to all of us, surely. Old age or mature years is no obstacle to serving God. So, I won't point people out, but if you think of yourself as an older Christian, the church needs you. It needs your wisdom and your experience. The world needs to hear your testimony and see your faith in action. And younger Christian, I wonder, do you want to be thought of as useful when you're 80 years old? Useful to the church, useful to God. How can you do that? Well, the best way is, like Daniel, to start now and keep on being useful year after year after year, and to live a life of consistent service and faithfulness to God. I wonder, are we useful in the church? Are we faithful to God? Daniel is still useful at 80 years old, and he's a man of honour and integrity. Verse 3, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So the king sees he's chosen the right man. Daniel's doing a good job. In fact, Daniel is doing so well, the king thinks, actually, those other satraps, I can kind of get rid of them and make Daniel in charge of everything. So how do you think those guys are going to respond? Well, of course, with envy and opposition. It means they can't feather their own nest anymore. They could be out of a job. The governors think, well, actually, Daniel's going to be looking over my accounts next year, not this other satrap. I won't be able to make any money. I won't be able to advance in the kingdom. So they gang together to try and find fault with Daniel, but they can find no fault with him. The administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We'll never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." They recognize very quickly the only possible point at which they can attack Daniel is in the way in which he obeys the law of his God. Because Daniel is a model citizen. Even in a foreign land, he obeys the laws of the land. He's been working for the state, for the government. He's been working hard with honesty and integrity. He's trustworthy. But as he works in that way, it's also clear to everyone around him, people know who it is he serves. They know that he serves his God first and foremost, and they recognize this as a point of weakness at which they can attack him. I wonder, do people round about know that we serve God? Do they know, first of all, though, they can trust us to deal with them with honesty and integrity? Do we live lives that proclaim that Jesus Christ is our Lord? You see, Daniel is faithful to God, but why? We should be faithful to God, but why? Because God doesn't promise that the faithful will be free of opposition. Daniel is God's righteous servant, but he's in danger. God's righteous servant in danger. You see, rather than having an easy life, the righteous and the faithful to God must expect opposition. We must expect opposition. Jesus promised his disciples that they would be opposed, that if the world hated Jesus, they would hate his disciples as well. And as we go through this story now of Daniel in the lion's den, we see the lions are on the prowl. But these are human lions. Look at how the writer portrays Daniel's opponents. They're not individuals. They're not named. They're a prowling gang seeking to devour Daniel. Verse 6. So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever." The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, Your Majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now you might wonder, why is the lion's den a place where Daniel might get thrown? What have lions got to do with punishment in Persia? Well, the kings of those days actually would keep packs of lions. So particularly the Assyrians, who were a few hundred years earlier, if you go to the British Museum, and I recommend a trip to the British Museum if you've got fit legs and can go for a long walk because it's very big. But there are friezes of Assyrian kings hunting lions. So they would keep some hungry, ferocious lions, and then when they decided they wanted a bit of fun, they'd let the lions loose and go off in their chariots and try and kill the lions. That means these lions are going to be pretty big and ferocious. As, after all, if a king kills a wimpy lion, it's not much of a king, really. If you look at the friezes in the British Museum, you do see that when the king's chasing the lions, there's plenty of soldiers around just in case. So that's why the king would have had a pack of lions ready. For sport. But the human pack of lions, these men who have conspired against Daniel, they're clever and capable men. These are the best minds in the land. They're skilled administrators. They're intelligent, but so sneaky. And look at how they flatter the king. And they lie, don't they? Because they say that all the administrators and satraps had agreed. But Daniel wasn't involved in this conspiracy, obviously. And I wonder if the king had known that Daniel was not a signatory to this idea, I suspect he would have had no part of it. The king doesn't realise this is a law just to get at Daniel. He's actually his favourite administrator, his most trusted advisor. And so he issues the law. Verse 8. Now, Your Majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Notice how the written law of the Medes and Persians, it stands, it cannot be overturned. And this is emphasized three times as the writer tells us that the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be repealed. And each time as the writer says that, it's like the tolling of a bell, the tolling of a funeral bell. And the pealing of the bell, because the law cannot be repealed. The law has been passed. It's on the statute book. It cannot be repealed. Daniel is faced, isn't he, with a challenge. How will Daniel respond? Well, surely the temptation is, keep my head down for 30 days. It's only a month. I've been praying to God for 66 years, three times a day. I'm sure he'll let me off a month. And maybe some of us have gone a month without praying, and you know, you think maybe just Daniel could have gone a month without praying. Surely that would have been okay. God would have forgiven him. God can permit him a few days off. Wouldn't that be the wise, the sensible, the prudent thing to do? You know, keep your head down, don't pray for 30 days, and then you have an extra prayer session for a few weeks afterwards, maybe to make up for it. How would we respond if we were faced with that challenge? How do we respond when we are asked to lie or to twist the truth at work? How do we respond when friends ask us to get involved in behaviour or activity that we know that God hates? When we're in a conversation and we know we've got an opportunity to speak for Jesus Christ and as it were, to defend the gospel, we've got that opportunity and we're so afraid to do so, aren't we? And every day in 100 other situations, we face this kind of choice. God or other people? God or my safety? What do we do? And why do we do that? What does Daniel do? Verse 10. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room, where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. What's almost the first thing we read about Daniel? As a young teenager, when he faced a similar choice, turn back to chapter 1. And the situation is that Daniel has been brought to the University of Babylon. And he's going to be fed the best food and wine in the land straight from the king's table. But he knows that's against God's law. He knows God doesn't want him to do that. Well, we read in verse 8 that therefore Daniel resolved, 14-year-old boy, not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Daniel resolved. And 66 years later, nothing in Daniel has changed. Daniel is still resolved, determined to be faithful to God. And notice he doesn't change his practice here in chapter 6. There is no emergency prayer meeting. I'm not saying emergency prayer meetings are wrong. I'm just saying Daniel doesn't hold an emergency prayer meeting. He simply carries on with his normal practice as he'd been doing day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. And he opens the windows in his house that face toward Jerusalem. And he looks to the Lord for help. Why does he pray towards Jerusalem? Is this some kind of superstition? Some kind of magic formula that means God will listen to him? Well, you might have to turn back in your Bible to 1 Kings and chapter 8, which is where Solomon is dedicating the temple that he's just built for the Lord. 1 Kings and chapter 8. If somebody's got the page number, maybe they could shout it out, please. 243, thank you. And Solomon makes this wonderful prayer of dedication of the temple. And he recognizes that actually the people of Israel are going to sin. And that when they sin, when they disobey, when they forsake God, God is going to exile them. He's going to send them into a foreign land. And so Solomon prays that when the people in a foreign land, when they repent of their disobedience and turn back to God, look at it in verse 48. Verse 48. If they turn back to you with all their heart and soul in the land of their enemies who took them captive, and pray to you toward the land you gave their ancestors, toward the city you have chosen, and the temple I have built for your name, then from heaven your dwelling place, hear their prayer and their plea, and uphold their cause. See, Daniel is following the prayer of Solomon. He's facing Jerusalem to reflect the fact that he's seeking out God. He wants to meet with God and pray to God and plead with God. So he faces Jerusalem. And the gang come and they find Daniel praying. And the gang, they return to the king and they say, King, didn't you pass a decree? And the king answered, verse 12, the decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. And we hear the bell toll for Daniel a second time. And then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. The king finally realizes he's been outwitted. He's appointed some clever men, and they're more clever than he is. And so he tries his utmost to get the thing changed. You can imagine him, can't you? Presumably they've come to him in the morning. So he's on the phone to his legal advisers and all the justices of the peace and so on, and the high court. He's saying, can't we kind of, there must be a loophole here. We can get out of this, can't we? And he calls in all his top solicitors, and he goes to the university, to the legal department, and he says, is there some precedence? Can we kind of get Daniel off the hook here? I don't want Daniel to be killed. Daniel's my right-hand man. I need him. And he's rushing around frantically, finding, can I get out of this? Well, in the evening, the king hasn't found an answer. and the conspirators, they return to the king to remind him about his decree. Verse 15, remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. And Daniel is the one for whom the bell tolls. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you. Daniel is thrown to these hungry and powerful lions. And a stone is rolled across the entrance to the den of the lions. And seals are placed upon the stone, the king's seal, and the seals of his nobles and officials, so that no one will dare to rescue Daniel. Daniel has no hope. This den of lions is to be his tomb. There is nothing that can save him now. Now, not many of us are faced with quite so radical a choice as Daniel was faced with, serve God or die. But every day we face many choices between serving God and pleasing other people, or between serving God and pleasing ourselves. What choices do we make? You see, Daniel chose to serve God rather than to save his life. But why? And we know, don't we, that we should choose to serve God, even if it means ridicule, disadvantage, even if it means suffering, even if it means death. We know that, don't we? But why should we? Daniel is God's righteous servant in danger. But thirdly, delivered. But delivered. Next morning, the king gets up early. And you can imagine the servants in the palace who are lighting the lamps or preparing breakfast see this strange sight of the king rushing along the corridors. Perhaps he's not changed. He's still in his disheveled clothes from yesterday. And he rushes to the den of lions. He's coming anxiously, and no doubt what he expects to find is a few crushed bones, some scraps of torn cloth, and a few bloodstains. And the strange sight goes on as the king calls out. He calls out, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel answers. For the first time in the story, Daniel speaks. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? King saying, Daniel, are you there, when he's in a den of lions? But Daniel speaks. You see, no one could save Daniel. He had no hope at all. He couldn't save himself. His friends couldn't save him. None of the officials could save him. In fact, not even the king who made the law can save him from his own law. But the Lord God saved him. And here's what Daniel says, verse 22. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I done any wrong before you, your majesty. This is the great, overarching, repeated, thunderous message of this book of Daniel. Is that God is sovereign. God is in charge. God rules over absolutely everything. In fact, he even rules over the minds and the hearts and the actions of the mightiest rulers of this world, even when those rulers don't acknowledge him. Because God's power is unsurpassed, and no one can resist his will. And for the second time in this book of Daniel, we see the angel of the Lord sent to save his people. The first time, I don't know if you've read it in Daniel chapter 3, we read of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And they're thrown, aren't they, into the fiery furnace because they would not bow down to the idol. And mighty King Nebuchadnezzar, he sees them in the fiery furnace. And he says, doesn't he? He says, didn't we throw three men into the fire? But I can see four walking around and unharmed, and one is like a son of the gods. The angel of the Lord came to protect those men from the fire. The angel of the Lord came to shut the mouths of the lions. You see, God did not protect Daniel from facing the lions. But he protected Daniel in the face of the lions. He didn't protect Daniel from facing the lions. He protected Daniel in the face of the lions. And he stood with Daniel. And he closed the lion's mouth. And this angel of the Lord appears time and time in the Old Testament in various places. And these are appearances of the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, the living Word before he became flesh. This is Jesus Christ come to rescue Daniel. And what we see here for Daniel in very physical terms, very literal terms, is what is promised for believers in Jesus Christ as we face trials of every kind. The Apostle Paul faced many trials and persecutions, and eventually he was imprisoned in Rome. And he wrote to Timothy, his protege, from prison in Rome. And we read in 2 Timothy 4, Paul says, "At my first defense," presumably the first legal appearance he had before the court, "no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them." But he says, "But the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. And I was delivered from the lion's mouth." You see how Paul takes his situation in that court in Rome and says he was like Daniel facing the lions. Paul was facing the lions of the Roman officials who were out there to prove that he should be executed. And he says, like Daniel, the Lord stood with me and I was delivered from the lion's mouth. Because God promises to be with us through all our trials. Jesus said to his disciples, "Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." Daniel says he was innocent. He says he was innocent. He's not regarding himself as sinless. But he knows that in this situation, before the king, he is innocent of any treason or disloyalty. He's innocent in this matter in which he's been accused. And he's behaved as God commanded. And the writer adds this, verse 23, "When Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God." Daniel trusted in God. And therefore God counted him innocent. And therefore, the lesson for us is, because God is sovereign and mighty, in every situation that we face today, we need only to trust in him. We need to have faith. What does that mean? To have faith means to listen to what he has said, to believe what he has said, and to follow, to obey what he has said, to do it. And immediately the pack of Daniel's enemies are thrown to the lions and they perish. They're crushed before they even reach the floor. And the writer doesn't particularly comment on this. He's just recording what it is the king did. But I believe it is a picture for us of a future judgment. A future judgment on those who will oppose God and those who will oppose God's people. And the earlier decree of the king, the anti-God decree, is now replaced by a new command. Where now is the written law of the Medes and Persians? That law which cannot be repealed. Where is it? It's been repealed by God. And God's replaced it with a new decree. Verse 26, the king says, "I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." And yet again, God's sovereignty, God's control is shown, because he brings praise from the lips of a pagan king, from the most powerful man in the world. And we see Daniel continues to prosper, even in his 80s, even now in the final few years of his life. So we see God's righteous servant. Even though he's in great danger, God delivers him from certain death to prosper. So in your life, in my life, how will we live? Will we trust him? Will we believe him? Will we obey him? This account gives us a really solid reason why we should. God is sovereign, and God rescues his people, even from the lion's den. Daniel is God's righteous servant in danger, but delivered. But as we looked at God's righteous servant, delivered as it were from his tomb, I wonder, did it not remind you, if you know your Bible, of another of God's righteous servants? There was a man, you see, who was found innocent of any crime. There was a man who was totally faithful to God. There was a man who trusted and obeyed God in the face of huge opposition. There was a man who was delivered over to death through the conspiracy of wicked men, whose envy of him led to hatred and to murder. And this man who was slain was placed in a tomb, and a stone was rolled across the entrance of the tomb, and a seal was placed on that stone so no one could dare remove it. No one could steal his body away. And then his friends came hurrying that first Easter morning to find that he wasn't there, because God had raised Jesus from death to life again. This is the story, this account of Daniel in the lion's den. It tells us God is in charge. It tells us God rescues his people, but it tells us most of all of a resurrection. Because in this life, we're not always delivered from immediate danger. We're not always delivered out of suffering and persecution and delivery difficulties. The Apostle Paul, who said he was rescued from the lion's den, from the mouth of the lions, went on to suffer martyrdom at the hand of the Romans. But if you're trusting in Jesus Christ, if you're a Christian this evening, you know, you can be sure that your future is secure in God's hands, because Jesus was raised from the dead as the first of many to be raised. And we looked on Easter Sunday evening at 1 Corinthians 15, Paul's great chapter. We looked at a few verses there. And there Paul writes that Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive. But each in turn, Christ the first fruits, then when he appears, those who belong to him. Living in multicultural Britain, under pressure from society and secularism, how should we live? Well, of course, we should be faithful to God. We know that. We should be obedient to him. We should trust him. We should depend upon him. We should be working in society, not withdrawing from society. We should be witnessing to him by our actions and our words. We know that, don't we? But why should we do that? Why face that struggle every day? Because it will bring opposition. It may bring danger. So why? Well, first of all, God is sovereign. So actually, the sensible thing to do when faced by serving God or facing death is to serve God, because he's in charge. But even more, there is the promise of a resurrection when Jesus appears for those who put their faith in him. Let's sing together our final hymn, a resurrection hymn. I know that my Redeemer lives. What comfort this assurance gives. He lives who once was dead. He lives, my everlasting head.